Thanks for listening to this Word in Your Ear podcast. If you'd like to get early access to all our productions ad-free, priority booking for our live events, and to take part in our weekly quiz, go to patreon.com/wordinyourear for more details.
You're listening to a podcast from The Word.
Okay, new game. We've had enough of Alexa.
Go on.
New game, as suggested by... You know, we were talking about Stackwaddy the other week.
Stackwaddy. The inimitable and unforgettable Stackwaddy.
Stackwaddy. Yes. It were on the Dandelion label, and whose first album was called Bugger Off. Yes.
Called Bugger Off.
It was called Bugger Off. There was some correspondence from people who at first didn't believe that Stackwaddy existed, you know, because when if you're not a certain age like you and me, you think things like that are just figments of people's imagination. So that gave me an idea. The Stackwaddy game goes as follows. I give you three names of bands, okay? One of them is made up, okay? The other two really were names of bands, or possibly still are, yes?
Oh, right, so two of them, okay, two of them are real.
Two are real.
And one is
two
made
are
up.
Real.
Oh, okay.
One's made up. One was never a name of a band. And you've got to decide. Okay, here's my three. Ham, Pie Wacket, Somp. Ham.
Somp is S-O-M-P.
No, S-U-M-P, Ham, Pie Wacket, Sump.
Ham, Pie Wacket. Okay, well, look, that's very interesting. They're all pretty much of the same era, I think. Pie Wacket, I think, exists, actually. I'm sure I've heard of Pie Wacket. So I'm going to say that they're real. Sump, again, they could have been a kind of early... clod-hopping, slightly metallic, heavy rock act from 1971 based in Stevenage. Or they could, alternatively, have been, I suppose, a kind of 1991 Select magazine up-and-coming moose float, you know, ride-type group. But I think I'm going to go for some. Ham, I'm saying, did not exist. Nobody would call a group Ham. It implies insincerity, it implies facetiousness. It just doesn't really work. Pie Wacket, I think I've heard of Pie Wacket, actually, and I'm sure they existed. And
solution.
So Pie Wacket and Sump.
Okay, the solution is Ham existed and still exists. Okay, they formed in 1988. No. They're an Icelandic rock band. Pie Wacket, formed in the late 1970s, playing pop music from the last five centuries. The one that doesn't exist and didn't exist is Stomp. And you're absolutely right, your analysis, that it belonged in the 90s. Kind of shoegazing type group.
It's shoegazing.
In the select magazine era. So I win that round, but go on, you're going to have a go
really
at me.
You really do win. Well, no, I'd scribbled down a couple when you mentioned this a few minutes ago, and I think I got the brief wrong, because only one of these is real.
Oh, right. Oh, okay. Well, no, it
but
still
see if,
works.
See,
okay.
see if you can get on with it. It's the same thing. Yeah, okay. So, same thing. Okay. So the first one is congratulations on your decision to become a pilot. That's the first one. Okay. The second one is The Way Out. And the third one is Mr. Perkins and His Pink Hat. So those scores again. Congratulations on your decision to become a pilot. The Way Out.
Way
and
out.
Mr. Perkins and His Pink Hat.
And only one's real.
Yeah.
Mr. Perkins and His Pink Hat is real.
Oh, my Lord. Wow.
Did I get it right?
I didn't believe it. No, we've both won. That's extraordinary. No, Mr. Perkins' Pink Hat is not real. Although it's quite like the name of a mate of mine's band in the 1970s. But no, it's not real. And I thought it just sounded absolutely perfect for that kind of period, a group based possibly public school boys living in Cheney Walk in Chelsea in kind of February 1968. So do you know what I mean? Exactly.
Oh, yeah. All right. Well, maybe.
So that was my thing. The other one that I thought was, I put it there, I thought it might be easy to rumble, actually, because it sounds like one of those groups that should have been a group called The Way Out. Don't you think? There should have been.
That's true.
But then, why wasn't there a band called The Way Out? But there wasn't. So that's not true either. No, the real one is, congratulations on your decision to become a pilot.
Go on.
Who formed in 1999 in Oshkosh, Wisconsin, and disbanded in 2001. And they were a post-hardcore emo group. Well, that's a great name, isn't it?
It's good. Do you
remember there was a band that Peel used to play all the time? Yeah, Peel used to play all the time called the entire crew of the HMS Ark Royal. That's another great name.
Wasn't there also
best,
a group
best
called
band
Danger...
name ever? Go on.
Go on. There wasn't there also
look
a group
out
called
something as a dog behind you.
Danger Quintin, there's a dog behind you.
That's right. That's what
Danger Quintin, there's a dog behind you. That used to be a regular joker smash hits. Yeah, so there you go. So that's the Stackwaddy game. Stackwaddy game, you can play it in your parlour while away the long lockdown evenings with your beloved. So let's have
best
a game of the Stackwaddy game.
We used to make up names. We had the smash hits readers poll. We used to put in people you could vote for. You know, Howard Jones, Spandau Ballet, you know, Tears for Fears or whatever. And we used to put in, I remember the Flying Savoy Brothers and Janet. They were always in there. They never got any votes. It's good, isn't it? And the Human Source Band, the Orinoco. Best group name ever, I think. This is a very boring choice, but I still think it's the best, is Foo Fighters. I think that's an absolutely brilliant name. I do, because it's brilliant. The Foo Fighters were, if I remember rightly, part of the Air Force that specialised in fighting UFOs. If unidentified flying objects ever came into view, they would dispatch the Foo Fighters. So it has a great sense of mystery. And it's brilliant to say, and it looks good written down. It's just a great name, Foo Fighters. A lot of magic. It's good. Worst name ever, the Beatles. We've been through this before.
Indeed.
This is a Word Lockdown special. Call it herd immunity.
I wanted to talk about, there's a podcast, it's rare on this podcast we talk about another podcast. This is a podcast which comes out this week, I think, from Spotify. It's sort of an eight part podcast, much ballyhooed, called Winds of Change. Have you heard about this?
Yes, I have. Yeah, Patrick Radden Keefe is a New Yorker writer, isn't he? I think, and if I remember rightly, he'd done a huge podcast about the idea that a power ballad by the Scorpions that came out in 1990, Winds of Change, was in fact written by the CIA
Somebody had told him this 10 years earlier or something like this. And somebody who was a kind of well clued up person, that, you know, this had been written by the CIA and kind of slipped into the kind of the European pop bloodstream in order to expedite the collapse of the Soviet Union. And Patrick Radden Keefe is very, very good writer, very good journalist, wrote a fantastic book about Northern Ireland, if anybody's interested, called Say Nothing, which is, I cannot recommend too highly. And anyway, this podcast is big. It's a big production. And I listened to the first episode of it just recently. And much of this is taken up with him saying to his mate, I find it hard to believe that the CIA would kind of have a music writing division and would somehow originate a power ballad. You see, now I have to say,
I agree with
you. I come at it with a completely different hat on here. You see, I find that entirely plausible. I find it completely plausible that somewhere in the CIA there is some kind of Ricky Gervais in the office type character who's written a power ballad called Winds of Change. I don't have any difficulty with believing that at all. because I think every organisation on God's earth at the moment, from a large governmental one to a medium-sized private one, has somebody working in there who harbours fantasies of writing a big rock ballad. I think that
Ricky Gervais comparison.
Absolutely. Free love on the free love highway.
Free love on the free love highway.
It's all the same thing. I don't have any difficulty with that bit of it at all. This is the bit that I have difficulty with. Coming with my kind of, you know, close observation of the record business hat on, I think the difficult bit in the whole business is how do you get the Scorpions to do it? Because the whole business, nothing is more fraught with kind of, nothing is more likely to go wrong than the progress that takes a song onto an album, onto a single, onto an A-side, then onto a hit. You know what I mean? If you sat there in the CIA and said, oh, I tell you what, Chief, I've got an idea of how to bring down the, you know, the Berlin Wall. This is what we're going to do. We're going to write a song called Winds Have Changed. We're going to get it to Scorpions. You're going to get it to who? We're going to get it to Scorpions. Okay. We're going to persuade them somehow, either with their collusion or without it, to put it on their album. And then they're going to put it out as a single, and it's going to be a huge hit. I would say, if I was their boss, you've as much chance of scoring a hat-trick in a World Cup final as you have of bringing off that series of events. Because nothing goes wrong.
What if they were to offer them huge amounts of money? No, true. But what if they were to offer them huge amounts of money?
All right. Well, if they did, I think it's rather unlikely because I don't think it's easy to bribe rock bands. You know, I don't think you find the right person to bribe. You know, the power in rock bands is so kind of all over the place. You can't get them in a room and say,
and there's so many people involved in the decision as well, isn't
absolutely.
It?
So there's the publisher.
There's always going to be somebody. Exactly, yeah.
And even if you've done it, then the difficult bit is getting them to keep quiet about it. Because, you know, we all know, there are stories, a legion in the music business about, oh, you know, so-and-so is supposed to have written that. Well, actually, it was secretly written by Joe over here.
Take that and the Bee Gees.
Who doesn't like to talk about it, you know. Well, in the end, they always talk. Always, always, always talk. You know, the idea that they would keep this secret just seems to me far-fetched. Now, it's a really good podcast, and I recommend people listening to it. And maybe they've got copper bottom proof by the end of it that this is what happened. But I would say it's a pretty damn long shot, you know.
It's a very thin and flaky proposition, isn't it, don't you think, for a several series podcast? Also, why is it taking so long for it to come out? Because the record came out in 1990. Indeed, the Cold War, of course, did end in 1991, though.
Oh, yeah, by coincidence.
Brought down by this record, yeah.
Brought down by this record.
Yeah.
But anyway, I was thinking about this whole business, kind of what a lottery it is. You know, how certain records get to be hits and other ones don't. And I was also, we were talking about this, the sad death of Alan Merrill, you know, who
died in...
Yeah,
that's an amazing story.
In the United States a few weeks ago. And I have to confess, I didn't really know much about this guy. But his claim to fame, and the reason he's got an obituary in the New York Times, is he was one of the people who wrote I Love Rock and Roll. So, you know, if anybody needs reminding how I Love Rock and Roll goes, there he is.
And that is the Arrows version, isn't it? The group he was in.
That's the Arrows version. He's an American. It's an extraordinary tale. He's an American.
Yeah, amazing tale.
I think he tries to get into the Left Bank in the 1960s, the Left Bank being the kind of Michael
Brown.
He
auditioned for the Left Bank.
Yeah, the Michael Brown-led group who had Walk Away, Room, Renee. And then he went to Japan and he became... A kind of a star, didn't he? Singing Japanese
bubblegum pop
language, bubblegum pop songs. And then he ended up in England in the mid-70s, and he was a member of the Arrows. And the Arrows were a kind of would-be Bay City Rollers-type act who had a TV series on Granada, short-lived TV series. Round about the time, you know, Granada used to do all these kind of tea time things. Round about the time they did a Mark Boland series, didn't they? Muriel Young used to produce all these kind of things for Granada. And anyway, he and another member wrote I Love Rock and Roll. And the amazing thing is they wrote it and they put it on the B-side of this.
Isn't that astonishing? Yeah.
Here's the tune that they thought was better.
It's astonishing. And Joan Jett was over touring, wasn't she, and heard it? Is that right? What was the story? How did she run into it?
So that's the tune that they thought was better, which you can't believe anybody ever thought that was better than I Love Rock and Roll. She happened to be touring Britain with the Runaways, and she happened to catch the TV programme that they played I Love Rock and Roll on, and she thought, quite sensibly, that's a huge hit record.
You know, it is.
You know, the Arrows hadn't thought it. The TV producer hadn't thought it. The record business, the record company hadn't thought it, but she sat there in a hotel room and thought, my God, that's a hit. And so when she left the Runaways, went out on her own, pretty much the first thing they did was they covered I Love Rock and Roll. And she had her entire career is based on I Love Rock and Roll. Just based on that. So, you know, if the CIA... You know, if the CIA want to know how you get a hit, a song to be a hit, you know, it's that kind of succession of mad coincidences is what more often than not makes those things happen, rather than conspiracies. People have always got conspiracy theories about the record business. In my experience, the record business cannot coordinate anything, let alone a conspiracy. You know, the idea that they can all get in a room and say, "This is what we're going to do." It doesn't happen, does it? At all.
No, it's the majority of pop music is happy accidents, I think. Just extraordinary coincidences where things just run into each other and, you know.
And then that, you know, that then reminded us of the, you know, the number of times that huge hit records have started life on the B-side. Were never intended. You know, the classic
we
case.
We Are the Champions?
Was that one of them? We Are the Champions.
I think so. I think We Are the Champions was the B side of We Will Rock You. I think the various ones. Revolution, I think, was a B side, but the Beatles, wasn't it?
Well, that was kind of double A side, wasn't it?
The double A side. The Model by Kraftwerk. I can't remember if that was double A side, but I think it's the B side of Computer Love. And also that you can't always get what you want by the Stones was, I think, the B side of Honky Tonk Women. So I mean,
yes, they were.
Became huge records, didn't they? Go on, which one were you going to mention?
The classic one I always think is Maggie May, Rod Stewart. Wasn't even supposed to be on the album because
not
they didn't
the
think
album,
it was
right.
good enough. Not even on the album.
It was good enough.
And so they put it... they didn't think it was good enough. And they put it on the B-side of Reason to Believe was the A-side. And it was only when a DJ in Cleveland flipped it and said, no, that's the hit, that they started working Maggie May. And Rod Stewart's entire career has been built on that song.
I know, that's extraordinary.
Completely by an accident.
Just weird little twists of synchronicity. I know. And that's the same with Alan Merrill. I mean, Alan Merrill must have bankrolled the rest of his life, mustn't it? Because that's a massive...
Oh, sure, absolutely.
Still gets played.
Absolutely.
She gets played all the time.
Yeah. He was still playing in New York, you know, up until his... You know, sad death recently as a victim of the coronavirus, which is the only reason that kind of came to my attention. But I thought it was interesting at the same time as the winds of change conspiracy theories. You know, do you believe
it
in
is,
conspiracies
it is.
Or do you believe in mad coincidences? I tend to believe in mad coincidences.
This is a lockdown special from The Word. You ain't going nowhere.
So I was reading this piece in online from about a gig that's happening in Arkansas on Friday. Today's the 14th, and it's happening tomorrow, the 15th of May. And it gives you an idea of what life is going to be like on the live circuit, well, certainly what it's like at the moment. Bravely, they're going ahead with Travis McCreedy's country star, his gig. And it's a venue that they can only sell 229 seats out of 1,100. So you can imagine how empty it already feels. Everybody going compulsorily has to wear masks. So that cuts down, conversation and human interaction already. If you haven't got a mask, you can buy one there. They're for sale in the venue. You're divided into little pods of 12. They're called fan pods, which I think presumably have Perspex sheets in between them. But up to 12 people can sit in a designated area. Your temperature is taken on the way in, and your temperature is taken on the way out. You can't touch the paper towels or the soap dispensers. Only 10 allowed in the toilet at any one time. Any food or drink bought is kind of already prepared for sandwiches and wrappers, And it just made me think, is there any concert at all that you'd be prepared to go through that kind of privation and restriction for the privilege of paying $20 plus fees to go and enjoy it? I can't imagine there would be.
I can't imagine
this experience.
Now, when you were first describing it, I thought to myself, doesn't that mean that the people who go are all separated from each other? But you've said that they can be in groups of, I think, 11, did you say?
But no, within those groups, they've got to be separated. No, within pods, those designated areas, they've got to be separated. They've got to be distanced from each other. The only way this is going to work
is it will appeal to those acts whose fan base is made up of complete loners. And you must have cases of this. There must be cases where you think to yourself, I want to go and see so-and-so, but clearly my wife will not be paid to go and see them with me, And I haven't got a mate who likes them also. You kind of quite like to go on your own. There must be a seam of acts who just appeal to absolute misfits. For whom the act of going to see them is not in any way social. Yes? Does that make any sense?
I can't immediately think who
that would be. I don't know.
I can think of one off the top of my head. There was a group in about 1980 called the Young Marble Giants. Remember them? It was a woman, I think, called Alison Statton, and they were a kind of ambient pop act who were the most kind of bedsit group imaginable, and very kind of very dislocated looking, librarian types with big glasses and baggy sweaters would sit on their own and listen to them patiently. There was no sense of social bonding or camaraderie. Nobody's on their feet leaping around, punching the air and screaming,
It made me think of Nico, because there's something about Nico. You can't imagine, well, sadly no longer with us, but, even when she was, you can't imagine the idea of going to see Nico and at the end of a number, turning to the person next to you, go, "This is good, isn't it?"
I know.
Exactly. I love
that. We ought to go and have a drink sometime.
I know.
Fantastic.
Those are the people.
A whole new wave of Joanna Newsom type, harp players.
Joanna Newsom. That's the kind of thing, But it's not the kind of... You can't see an immediate future for those acts that kind of encourage people to bond with each other, can you? You know what I mean?
Brilliant piece which you sent me of Dave Grohl, and I think I read it in The Atlantic, which you'd sent me, which was fantastic. Dave Grohl talking about how much he misses the idea of huge audiences playing. He described Freddie Mercury at Live Aid as playing 72,000 people as his instrument and joining them in harmonious union. It's really good. And Bruce Springsteen, a little quote from Bruce Springsteen, said, "When you look at an audience, you see yourself in them, just as they see themselves in you." And he says, "Will there ever be a return to that, that singing arm in arm at the top of your lungs, hearts racing, bodies moving, souls bursting with life?" I mean, that's what that you take the audience element away from a rock and roll band, like football game. And what have you got? It's what it's all about. Isn't it?
You've got a recital, is what you've got. You've got a recycle.
Yeah,
it's you know, it will. I mean, probably people will have to just, you know, move away from that kind of performance because, you know, he talks about the Freddie Mercury, you know, case, and that's a perfectly fair point. And but that way of performing only emerged as a consequence of playing in front of huge audiences in stadiums. And previously, yeah, it hadn't been done. It had not been done. You know. I think Bruce Springsteen only played. So when do we talk about Live Aid? We're talking 85, aren't we? Bruce Springsteen had only played outdoors for the first time that summer on tour at Slane Castle in Ireland. And they did that thing that American acts classically do, which is, if we're going to try something and it might go wrong, let's do it in Europe. We're not doing it at home, where our own homegrown media will be watching. That's to true. Judge if we're... Let's do it far from home. Let's do it in Ireland.
Let's hope the news never leaks back to them that we fucked up royally.
That's and the story, he tells the story, doesn't he, in his autobiography, Bruce Springsteen, about how at half-time he broke a load of things in the dressing room. He was so furious as to how frustrating it was to try and, you know, link up with an audience who were all over the place and, you know, looking at the sky and distract and all kinds of things. And Landau, his manager, said, well, this is what you're going to have to do. And that's what everybody did. But they only did it because they were playing in front of 80,000 people. And they did 80,000 people because they wanted to make enough money to pay for the tour. Well, you know, the big scale things, it seems to me, are not coming back in a hurry. It's going to go to smaller, point.
So if you were the Stones,
smaller things.
Yeah, if you were the Stones, or you were McCartney, or you were the Who, or whatever, would you, if you went back on the live circuit, whenever you're allowed to do that, let's say it's next year, can it be anything other than a reduced version of what you were before? You know, is it possible to imagine that the same number of people would turn out and see you? I find that hard to believe. So therefore, would you want to continue?
Well, I think two things. I wonder if the Rolling Stones have retired now. This is it.
It's possible, isn't it?
Because you know, they must have thought about it for years now. I mean, they're not going to announce it or anything like that. But have they done their last show? Does the same thing apply to The Who? Does the same thing apply to Paul McCartney and people like that? Bob Dylan's just called off his tour, hasn't he? I think he was supposed to be touring the United States in summer. It's clearly not going to do that.
God, he must be feeling discombobulated, seeing as he's been touring since, you know, the late 18th century.
What the hell? That's a good
what
one.
What is he doing?
What is Bob Dylan doing all day? Oh, God, I hadn't thought of that.
Because Bob Dylan lives in a tour bus. He lives for that routine of being... And you can understand how attractive it would be. If you're rootling around at home thinking, what am I going to do with myself? Compare that to being the centre of attention the entire time, somebody putting you on a tour bus, taking you somewhere, sound check, hotel, gig, making a fuss of you, never having to do anything at all apart from for 2 hours every night, turn up and play versions of Maggie's Farm that nobody recognises. That's a nice life, isn't it? That'd be good. So what is he doing? He's mooching about doing his welding.
God. Oh, that's good. That's good. Well, I think what'll happen eventually, they'll think, well, Bob can't go out. Let's bring fans in small numbers to Bob's house. And Bob can do what he does in front of them. And they'll pay $20,000 a person something like that.
That's it.
To be invited round to Bob's. And Bob's going to play off his back porch. Yep. You'll be at a safe distance. And you'll get a bit of an exclusive... experience. I think, and I'm making this up as I go along, you might get more exclusive experiences. I think you might ask more from performers than just doing your set. You might get more Q&As.
For the people who are prepared to pay a lot more for it.
People who are prepared to pay a lot of money. And there will be people who are prepared to pay a lot of money. And you'd
so
like
maybe
to
that
feel...
Bruce Springsteen on Broadway model, business model, is the new way forward. Because those were quite, relatively intimate gigs, weren't they? For which people paid, $1,500 or something, didn't they? Something absolutely enormous.
Well, they paid a lot, so but they except those were very, very kind of prescribed. They were very scripted, you know, those kind of, the recitals of a very particular kind of narrative. Whereas I wonder if you might see a bit more. Because if you pay $20,000, if you want a request, you get a request, I would have thought. Wouldn't you?
You've got to hope so.
If you, if you say, I want to hear Only a Pawn in the Game, you're going to get Only a Pawn in the Game. It might change the relationship, you know. I mean, God knows, it's incredibly difficult times for musicians, you know. Very, very uncertain.
Did you read that lovely
levels.
Thing that Dylan said about Little Richard? It was great. It was so sweet. He said something like, in his presence, he was always the same Little Richard that I first heard and was awed by growing up, and I was always the same little boy. That's a really nice thing to say, isn't it? Because he met Little Richard quite a few times. And immediately he went back to being, you know, how old would Dylan have been? He would have been 14, I suppose, when Little Richard had his first hit. Fantastic. I'm surprised there wasn't more about Little Richard's death, actually, which I don't think we've talked about in the podcast yet. I mean, obviously there's other things to write about, and that squeezed all this kind of stuff out of the frame. But my God, I was reminded of a thing that David Kirby wrote a book called Little Richard, The Birth of Rock and Roll. And he had this wonderful quote about Tutti Frutti. He said, according to Tutti Frutti, it's like the skinniest part of the hourglass. Everything that came before flows into this narrow pass, and the world we live in today flows out the other side. Well, that's an amazing thing to say. And it's sort of true, isn't it? All those kind of revolutions about race and sex and age and class and everything pretty much start with that record, don't they? You know, you said in your terrific Uncommon People book, you know, that's the first rock and roll star. You know, that's the beginning. He's the guy who galvanises Lennon and McCartney and the Stones and Dylan and Elton John and everyone. And it's just, I mean, his level of achievement is astonishing, don't you think?
And of course, when Bob Dylan left school and, you know, in his final high school yearbook, they said, what's your ambition? He had to say ambition. And he said,
oh, yeah.
To join Little Richard. As if Richard was running a kind of army somewhere and he was going to go off and join it. You know what I mean? As if it was some kind of religious movement that you could sign up to join Little Richard. So, you know...
That's right. It's
a remarkable and unique legacy.
You're listening to The Word Podcast. It's a lockdown lock-in.
Okay, yesterday's papers. What have you got?
Well, I had a dig around in the roof and I found a fantastic old copy of Zigzag. You can probably date it, Dave, actually, if I tell you that the groups that they write about are Lena Lovitch, The Scars, Nina Hagen, Telephone, The Nips, Punnilux, formerly Punishment of Luxury, Doll by Doll, The Lurkers. There's a great Lurkers piece with a headline. The headline just says, the headline is, what have the Lurkers been up to? That's good, isn't it? And the cover story is the don't dress it up anymore. You need to. And the cover story is the Slits take the cake, and the Slits have been baked a cake by Chris Needs, the editor, I think, or somebody.
So I'm going to say 1978.
Well, yeah, that's pretty much it. It's actually April 79. But I mean, it's funny how you're entering a little time capsule, aren't you? There's no kind, none of that kind of small ads and kind of popular culture stuff in Zigzag. It's just a collection of groups that they all think are hip. And it's great. Yeah. And
Chris Needs had taken over, wasn't
Chris
it?
Chris Needs is on the front. Where's the singles? This is how the singles reviews go. We've got the pop groups, She Is Beyond Good and Evil. What a great record, actually. And it just says, Nietzschean title confounds, but this is contemporary music. The pop group take themselves seriously. Do you? And that's the review. Amazing, isn't it?
I'm looking at a copy of the New Musical Express from the 25th of May 1968, and the singles in this particular issue were reviewed by Derek Johnson, and the headline over the single of the week is Earthy Stones must have a gigantic hit. And I wonder if you can identify the gigantic hit from the review. Well, this is the one you've been waiting for, folks. And I guarantee you won't be disappointed because it's vintage Rolling Stones. All the familiar ingredients are there. Urgent beat, juddering twangs, wailing harmonica, maracas, and Mick indulging in his mind-bending vocal pyrotechnics. What hit record do you think he's talking about there, Mark?
2,000 Light Years from Home, Jumping Jack... No, not Jumping Jack.
Yes, it is. It's Jumping Jack Flash. Jumping Jack Flash. Even though I'm not sure it's got a wailing harmonica on it.
But I don't think it has.
That's quibbling. Do you know what struck me as interesting? What struck me as interesting here is that it's using the expression "it's vintage Rolling Stones" in 1968. Yes, this is how That's long amazing, have they been it? Going? You know what I mean? They've been going four and a bit years or something like that.
And also, the Derek
and already
didn't
people
really
were saying
change very much.
Well, this is it. Already, people are saying they're back to their best. You know what I mean? They're back to what they do best. And that was Jumpin' Jack Flash. It didn't sound like anything they'd done before, really. It was kind of heavier. It's very different sound, wasn't it? It wasn't that kind of transistor radio sound of Satisfaction or We Loved You or anything like that. It was a very different, very American sound, wasn't it? And it's interesting. They talk about the vintage Rolling Stones. Let's get back. 1968, you know. It always
Which is pretty much
me,
the review that they've had ever since, isn't it? You know,
they've had it ever since.
Classic Stones sound. Yeah, this sounds like XL on Main Street. They're back.
This is it.
Brilliant.
They're back. They always say that.
The truth is that nobody wants them to change, you know. And if they don't change, they lambast them for that too. But they really
Don't we all like the idea of the Rolling Stones in the past, don't we? You know, it's just what they've had to live with. So, and also in this issue, it's got a track by track where the Small Faces go through their new album, their new circular album, Small Faces Storm Brain LP in Round Sleeve. And it's them going through track by track of Ogden's Not Gone Flake. It's absolutely fantastic. And so,
what do they say about Stanley Unwin?
So here's Keith Oltham writing about Stanley Unwin. Professor Unwin's voice is first heard inquiring if we're all sitting comfy bowl two square on your bodies before Happiness Stan crashes about our ears. Stan lives in the land of greens and coloured dreams, deep inside a rainbow. His big problem is that he cannot understand the mysteries on the other side of the moon. And this Steve sings to the thrashing accompaniment of piano, organ, drums and harpsichord. It's that kind of thing. No mention of drugs anywhere near it at all. You know,
no.
It's a children's story. It's a beautiful period piece. It's fantastic to read these things. And, you know, because that's how this stuff was regarded at the time. You know, there was none of the hindsight that we bring to it now, you know. They just
and
saw
those
it
reviews
in the
are often, and those reviews were often written probably in the office after about one quick hearing, almost as a news piece, weren't they? You know, they weren't let's go home and live with this album for weeks and really kind of commune with it and allow our lives to be changed. It's very much kind of, the organ is quite high on this one. There's some very perky bass playing and the drummer is no slouch. It's all that kind of thing, isn't it? You know, and
I've just noticed one of the first pieces in this issue is about Gary Puckett and the Union Gap. And the headline is Californian Union Gap Spurn the Psychedelic. Was psychedelic spelt wrong? Two S's in it. Psychedelic. It was obviously just quite early on in people had learned how to spell
with
psychedelic.
This.
It was a completely new name, you know, whereas nowadays people could type it without looking at it at all, you know. It wasn't the case in those days.
You're listening to The Word Podcast, where the time is whenever you want it to be.
I'm just finishing that Craig Brown Beatles book, 1, 2, 3, 4, and I'm reminded of a couple of stories I've forgotten. One is that McCartney, do you remember this, in autumn 1966 when they just played Candlestick Park, and for the first time in years they've got time off, and the Beatles got 3 months off before they start recording what becomes Sgt. Pepper in November. And he went on his own, this is astonishing when you think about it, he went on his own to Paris and took with him a wig and a false moustache, glasses and a hat, so he could go back to his previous anonymous life and see what it was like. He spent 2 or 3 days quite happily going around in disguise with his new handheld movie camera, and then tries to get into a club and they won't let him in. So he goes back to the hotel, takes his disguise off, and goes back as Paul McCartney. Of course, they're all over, you know. And he just remembers. He says, "I remember what it was like. I remember what it was like not to be famous, and it wasn't necessarily any better than being famous." It's rather sweet, really. It's an amazing story there, that McCartney walking around Paris at that time, one of the most famous people in the world, in disguise.
There's the famous story about it, around about the same time when Elvis Presley was doing his comeback special in Hollywood. Yeah. Steve Binder, however you pronounce it, was produced it. And he said to him, "Why don't you just go out in the street?" And he said, "I can't do that. I can't do that. I'll get mobbed. It'll be hopeless." So he said, "No, just come outside. We'll try it." So he went and stood outside on Hollywood Boulevard or wherever they were. And nobody noticed him at all. And so they went back indoors. Elvis not best pleased.
Yes. No, I'm sure. Oh, that's brilliant. There's another great chapter. Do you remember the story of Detective Sergeant Nobby Pilcher, who busts the Beatles and various other people? Yeah. I just forgot how amazing it is that everybody who came into the Beatles' orbit is so affected by them. And he's a weird combination of somebody who is, he's utterly in awe of them. And he also kind of envies their fame. And so he sets out on a series of major busts. They describe as a police groupie, as an autograph hunter with handcuffs. And he busts Donovan and then Mick Jagger and then Keith Richards at Redlands, that thing, you know, and then John and Yoko at Montague Square and eventually George and Patty. And the way he does it is to ring up the press beforehand to tip them off so that the press are covering these drug raids, so he gets the most amount of coverage. But, of course, the press were actually kind of in touch with the Beatles and would ring the Beatles and say that the drugs squad are on their way, at which point they would get rid of the stuff. And he therefore took the precaution of taking drugs with him, which he planted on the press. And they always complained about it and said, "Look, we don't have any of this stuff, and this guy's going to put bags of heroin in our front rooms. You know, we don't take it, etc., etc." And then and occasionally asked them for autographs and was completely spellbound in their presence. You know, and asked them about the new music and how the new albums were coming on. It's amazing. And then in the end was arrested for perjury and perverting the course of justice and sentenced to 4 years. So there's a bit of he got his just desserts.
My favourite element of that story is his name. He was called Pilcher.
Pilcher. Nobby Pilcher.
Is like a name out of a Joe Alton play, isn't it? You know, if you're going to do a seedy detective, it was going to be called Mr. Pilcher, wasn't he?
He was. The knacker of the yard. Absolutely. But he became immortalised as a giant hedgehog called Spiny Norman. And also he turns up in the Ruttles as the Ruttles character called Detective Inspector Brian Plant, who plants Indian tea and biscuits on members of the Ruttles and then arrests them. It's great. Extraordinary, though, the effect that I know, isn't that great?
Do you know what I've been thinking about from the past in these days? It's around about 51 years ago this week. Sounds like ancient history, but I do remember it happening. And since, tragically, the van crash happened, which killed Fairport Convention drummer Martin Lamb.
Oh, yeah, Martin Lamb.
And Richard Thompson's girlfriend, Jeannie Franklin. And which is obviously just an awful, awful thing. And but the amazing thing it makes you reflect upon, and this is 1969. In the year 1969, Fairport Convention released What We Did on Our Holidays in January, I think I'm right in saying, and then recorded and released Unhalf Bricking in the spring, I don't know, May, something like that. Then the crash happened. They were coming back from Mothers, I think, in Birmingham. They played Mothers in Birmingham. This terrible crash happened. And they subsequently kind of withdrew to a house in the country to sort themselves out and learn some different songs. And they got a new drummer, obviously, Dave Mattox and so forth. And so they recorded and released Legion Leaf in the same calendar year.
In the same year.
So they put out three phenomenal albums. Three extraordinary records with obviously slightly different lineups, and, you know, because Swarbrick kind of joined them during Unhalf Breaking, on it played on Sailor's Life and so forth. But I just don't think... It's just absolutely amazing. You know, they went through that terrible trauma, which must haunt them to this day. Just terrible. Van turned upside
and
down.
Also, and ended up that's incredible. And also kind of finished, kind of finalising the kind of the sound they were going to make, the group they were going to be, which is very based on listening to a band album, wasn't it? Didn't they listen to the band's second album and think, we're going to go back to the kind of... Well, traditional English songs as well.
You know, so they did. I mean, all those three records—they're all very different kinds of music, really. All really good records in their different ways. But it's just the fact of doing the three of them and releasing the three of them—it's
astonishing
in that
Absolutely
year. Just do you tell that to the bands of today? And they won't believe you.
The Word Podcast. What's wrong with being sexy?
Hope you're managing to keep up with our other activities during this time of enforced seclusion. I hope people have caught up with the Word in the Attic. What are we calling them, Mark? We can't call them video casts. They're not really that, are they? They're video chats with people that are on YouTube under Word in Your Ear. You'll
find
them.
Sounds a bit formal, doesn't it? Yeah, they're just basically people who've been rooting around the attic and found a few old records and things and, you know, scrapbooks and posters and pictures and stuff from their youth. It's brilliant, actually. God, we've done loads.
So we've had, who have we had recently? We've had Claire Grogan, we've had Leslie Ann Jones, we had Peter Curran. We had Miles Hunt. Going further back. I can't think. We've had Barney Hoskins. We've had all sorts of people. We continue recording them. Mark Lewison's there. Jim Irvin. And, you know, they're all there for you to enjoy. And, you know, people appear to enjoy them, which is very, very gratifying. To hear that they're doing that. And so if you feel like being one of our Patreon supporters, you'll also help all this happen, but you also get access to our rather exciting Saturday Tea Time quiz, which is entering its third week.
Which is going swimmingly.
It's going swimmingly well, actually, where we invite everybody via a Zoom link to take part in a quiz where they have to guess, according to a number of cryptic clues, which musical performer we're talking about. And also, so Patreon subscribers get access to that. We've also introduced a level where people can get access to the podcast slightly earlier than everybody else. So you'll be able to find details of that under our Patreon page, which will be under this podcast along with the program billing. You'll be able to find that there. So, Mark, I think you can tell us who are the people we're happiest to welcome as our new Patreon supporters. Over to you, Mark.
We should mention them. It's so nice and so immensely generous of our new patrons include the incorrigible Ian Martin and the peerless
Good
Andy
Ian.
Hamilton. Yeah,
excellent,
and the immaculate
Andy.
Simon's Slateholm. And the philanthropic Sean Campbell. And
Very
the
good.
Munificent Jonathan Holden. And the inimitable Simon Slater. We've had him already. Simon Slater must have presumably subscribed twice.
He's paid twice. What an excellent
chat. Twice. Yeah, the sensational Steve Jones. And the radiant Frank Inzani. And the impossibly generous Kieran Brennan. So thanks so much for all of that.
Thank you very much to all of them.
Really appreciate it. It's fantastic. Brilliant.
This podcast was brought to you by The Word.